Hello, and welcome to The Psychonaut Show with Dr. JKB. This is John K. Burton, MD, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. And on this podcast, your captain on these voyages to explore strange new worlds in inner space. Our mission is to uncover knowledge that will ultimately make us more effective, more connected, and more attractive in our daily lives. In this episode, we are going to get into the Testament of Neutrality, the first testament of the Psychonaut. In a later episode, I'm going to give an overview of the six testaments of the Psychonaut and explain why I've come up with these six as the principles that we need to guide us as we go forward in exploring our inner worlds. But the Testament of Neutrality is so important, I wanted to do an episode up front and explain that before we get too much further. The word testament maybe sounds a little antiquated or odd or just like too long, I don't know. So I did want to explain why I am using this word and why it's important. Now, I actually got the idea of testaments from the Quakers. And actually, the word Quaker was a pejorative word applied by other people. The Quakers called themselves Friends, Friends with a capital F. And in fact, the full name of this group of people was the Religious Society of the Friends of Truth. And I just love the idea of being the Friends of Truth. And I want psychonautic exploration to really be about truth and being a friend of truth. So that's why I sort of am doing a little homage to the Quakers. But I also like the word testament because rather than law or rule, it's related to the word testify, obviously. And testify means witness. The Quakers are very democratic. There is no hierarchy whatsoever. Everyone's voice is equal. And sometimes this causes problems and it can make them very inefficient, but they would rather not get something done than have one friend's voice overridden. And in terms of our exploration, the same thing, our unconscious, our inner worlds are all equal. They're not the same as one another, but they're equal. We want to have equal respect for all of them. And so I would much rather use the word testament, even if it's longer to say than law or rule, because it isn't something that comes from on high. It's something that we witness and observe together. I want to be clear that these six testaments are principles, they're fundamental, but they apply to our inner exploration. When we go forward into this inner exploration of the unconscious and our minds, we hopefully will find very useful tools and ideas that we can take back and apply to other areas of life. But the testaments, they don't have the same fundamental importance in other areas of life. So neutrality, for example, is about not judging. That doesn't mean that we can never judge in any area of life. Of course, we can and we should sometimes. But in terms of inner exploration, it is a fundamental principle. Non-judgment is another word for neutrality. And we cannot go one step further into our exploration without it. It's about not taking sides, not letting our personal biases interfere with understanding. So neutrality is testament number one, because we need to always strive for it when we are exploring the way our minds work. But it's not easy. It's not easy putting aside the values that have become part of how we make sense of the world and that guide us in our actions. So I want to give you another example of where the testament of neutrality is important. So a man came to me with a question about his marriage. He had been in a loveless, sexless marriage for a long time, though they had children together. He was feeling deprived in this relationship. He longed for the feeling of being loved by a woman, being loved emotionally, being loved physically. Now, his marriage to his current wife had had prior conflict to a worsening degree because of this situation, but they had gone to couples therapy and things were relatively more peaceful now, though they had never developed a physical, romantic, sexual, erotic relationship together. He described it as being more like roommates. And he wanted to know, is this normal? Do people have these kinds of marriages? When I asked him, why did he want to know if it was normal? He said it would help him to understand, should he stay in the marriage or should he get divorced? Now, for this man, it was not an easy question, as it really never is or never should be. He was aware that there was a certain peace, that divorce would cause disruption no matter what, and it does no matter what. It would affect the children who were, you know, in a place where they were getting ready for college, and maybe it would upset them during this process. On the other hand, could he live without this important part of life ever being experienced and gratified? Should he get divorced and pursue a life where he would have a fuller experience of a romantic relationship with a woman? This is a great example because it shows the red flags that help us see when the testament of neutrality is not being adhered to. And these are the words normal and should. Whenever we hear the words should, or whenever we hear the word normal, we know that some external standard of right and wrong, of how things ought to go, is interfering with our exploration of the inner experience. And what I told him, of course, was people live in all kinds of marriages. They live in conflicted marriages for years. They live in very sexual relationships or sexless relationships, and that's not the point. The point is, what kind of marriage, what kind of life did he want for himself? And that actually makes it more difficult because we often look to outside standards. Well, what's normal? What do other people do? I'll just do that. That's easy. It's a lot harder to say that doesn't matter. What matters is my experience, and I have to look at my feelings. And again, he had strong, valid feelings on both sides of the equation that he would have to consider in order to come up with the right decision for him. When we do that, we come forward with a decision that is based on more authentic information about ourselves, but it is more difficult to struggle with because we have to listen to both sides. And again, those red flags of should and normal interfere with that. We want to go to the easy thing. I'll just do what I should do. But listening inwardly leads us to a more sustained, more satisfying, and more effective solution. So I want to take a step back and give some of the psychoanalytic context of the testament of neutrality. Now, in psychoanalysis, they don't call it the testament of neutrality. That's my thing. But it is fundamental in psychoanalytic theory. And there's been a great deal written about it in the body of work of psychoanalysis. But I think probably the most important person, at least historically speaking, to talk about neutrality is Anna Freud. Anna Freud is Sigmund Freud's daughter, one of his daughters. And I see her as an overlooked and overshadowed person in the drama of the psychoanalytic characters that populate our history. She never married. She had no children. She was completely devoted to her father and, in fact, played a vital role in his work, transcribing letters for him, taking care of him in an intimate way when he was in terrible pain from cancer at the end of his life. And she is the one who, by herself, went to the Nazis and pleaded on her father's behalf. And the Nazis allowed her and her father to flee Vienna and move to London. There's a story that she went to her father and said that she wanted to go to medical school. This was after she was at a psychoanalytic meeting that her father had put together, and she saw one of the women doctors in her white coat, and Anna Freud was smitten. I think it was Helena Deutsch that she saw. And Freud dissuaded her from going to medical school and said that she should become a teacher. Now, that sounds like it could be sexist. And, you know, Freud has a reputation for saying reductionistic, sexist things about women. I think that he was of his time. But that's a simplistic way of thinking about him. And certainly vis-a-vis his daughter, it's not the motivation that led him to give her this advice. Freud had written an essay called On Lay Analysis, where he says that you don't have to go to medical school. You don't have to be a doctor or a psychiatrist to be a psychoanalyst. And we don't like to remember this in American, particularly psychoanalytic institutions. The history of psychoanalysis in this country until recently has been very guild-oriented, sort of these inner exclusive circles allowing certain people in and not others. And in fact, the Psychonauts show is trying to connect with the spirit of that idea. And Anna Freud actually did go on to be a teacher, and it was the right thing for her to do. And in fact, it was of greater benefit to the field of psychoanalysis. When she was in London, along with her friend and patroness, the American Dorothy Burlingham, she founded the War Nurseries, which were for children who were taken out of London during the bombings so that they could have a safe place to live. And she created a place where they could live comfortably, but also be observed, be studied, be understood. And she kept copious notes about their development, about their interactions, about how they grew, how they related to one another. She was really the first person, along with her contemporary and adversary, Melanie Klein, to really look at children directly. No one had done that before, including her father, Sigmund Freud. No one had actually directly looked at children. She and Melanie Klein were the first. And her work still goes on to this day at the Anna Freud Center in London. And the original case files of those children from back in the 40s are still there, and they are still studied and used as data today. So obviously, I think Anna Freud is pretty cool, and it might be a little bit of an overstatement to say she's the most important person when it comes to the concept of neutrality. But her quote about neutrality, the way she defines it, is very famous. And what she says is this: neutrality is when we take our stand at a point equidistant from the id, the ego, and the superego. Now, I haven't yet gotten to Freud's structural theory of the mind and what is the id and the ego and the superego, but very briefly, the id, and translated from German, it actually means it. We say id, but in German it means it, which can also mean child. It can refer to like a child, the child state. And that's where all of our drives occur, our sexual drives, our aggressive drives, hunger, etc. You know, want, I want. And on the other side, the superego is where we have our morals, our values, our ideas of how to live in society together. We get it from our parents, and then later we get it from the outside world. Things like don't be greedy, keep your sexuality in control, don't be mean. And then the ego is, in German, it was das Ich, the I. They translated it into ego in English to make it sound more scientific, but it's basically just the I. But the I is what's managing everything, trying to deal with what's coming at us from outside, what's coming at us from inside, and just kind of keep the peace. And so equidistant means I'm not aligning myself with any of these, not the inner drives, the wants, not the outer injunctions and values, the shoulds, and not just the management of them, but just sort of stepping back equidistantly, not taking any side, and observing all of them. So I've been talking about the theoretical concept of the testament of neutrality, but the Psychonauts show is about connecting these ideas to the larger world. So I would like to go real large and go back 2,000 years to Jesus. And all through the gospel, Jesus is talking about non-judgment. And I said earlier that non-judgment is basically equivalent, synonymous to neutrality. In the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 7, verse 1, Jesus says, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." In Luke, he says, "I came not to judge the world." And in the Gospel of John, there is the very well-known story of the woman allegedly found in adultery who is brought before Jesus to be put to death. And they say, "The law says she be put to death. What do you say?" And Jesus pauses before answering the question. And he, this is very clear in the gospel, he stoops down and writes in the sand. We never find out what he writes, which is fascinating, I think. And then he stands up and he addresses the crowd and says, famously, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." Just as an aside, I emphasize that little part of the story because I think it's really important, actually. It's obviously important because whoever wrote John thought that it needed to be in the story. But for us, in our exploration of inner worlds and our adherence to the testament of neutrality, it also provides some guidance that sometimes we need to pause and we need to kind of retreat from the situation for a moment before we can come back in a non-judgmental way. Now, Anna Freud, when she was talking about neutrality, and others, were talking about their technique, about how they're supposed to be with patients and what will lead to their growth and their change, and of course to understanding. But going back even further, you can see there is a spiritual precedent, if you will, for the testament of neutrality that I'm getting from psychoanalytic theory, but it's also in the gospel with Jesus. And then going from west to east, 2,500 years ago, in Buddhism, there is the concept of non-attachment, which is very similar to neutrality. Attachment is saying, I need things to be this way. I don't want things to be that way. This should happen this way. It shouldn't be this way. And that these kinds of judgments, this should be this way, shouldn't be that way. I want this or I don't want that. That would be like more like id speaking, but all of these attachments cause suffering. And so removing ourselves, really being equidistant from all of them, we're not judging them. We're standing equidistant from them because if we attach to them, they cause suffering. And certainly for our purposes, which are much more humble, I would say, than this millennia of spiritual traditions in the East and the West, never mind the 100 years of psychoanalytic tradition, more than 100 years of psychoanalytic tradition, that yes, that not adhering to the testament of neutrality causes suffering because it prevents us from listening effectively and exploring and understanding one another. So I want to give you one last example that shows how difficult it can seem to be to have values that we really care about and also to adhere to the testament of neutrality. So I was working with a poet in a workshop, a poetry workshop, for high school students with anxiety and depression. And this was back a while ago in the 90s, up in Washington Heights, before they made a musical about it. And, you know, a lot of these kids, really all of these kids, came from rough backgrounds, difficult home lives, dangerous neighborhoods, but they showed up each week and they worked really hard, not only emotionally on their vulnerable selves and expressing themselves, but also they learned a lot about poetry. They learned about the structure of different poems. They read poems from Emily Dickinson to Rumi, and they really learned and they took it so seriously. At the end of the year, we would put together an anthology and it was beautiful stuff. And for the kids, and for us, it created a sense of mastery, like we had done something important, and it was really helpful for their self-esteem and for expressing themselves on a deeper level. But at one point in one of the years, one of the boys made a homophobic comment about something. And the poet, I could see, got visibly angry and really felt like he needed to address this kind of hateful comment head on. And he chastised the kid. And I have to say, ironically, this poet is Buddhist, but in that moment, he was attached to his feeling that this was wrong and it needed to be clearly stated as such. What happened, though, is the boy kind of just, he didn't yell back. He didn't say anything. He just retreated and kind of got quiet. Was he going to change his mind or what he said because he got yelled at? You know, maybe. Maybe it made him think about himself. But the more important thing is that it was a missed opportunity to not react, to explore what he said and try to understand it. And I feel like in doing that, there was a greater possibility of thinking about himself and changing his mind. You know, I mentioned Jesus before, and Jesus told us we need to love our enemies. In the exploration of our inner world, when we meet hate or very problematic issues, I don't know that we don't have to love it. I mean, if you're a Christian, you need to love your enemies. But in this context, we need to simply be able to say neutrality, non-judgment. Let me not know what is going on here. Neutrality is not, though, about not caring. It's not about apathy. In fact, what it allows us to do is to empathize with the other person, and out of that may come an opportunity to change for the better. So the thing about neutrality is that it does take practice, and part of that is acknowledging our limits. I've given a couple of examples that show where people crossed their limits and they couldn't be neutral anymore. And I will tell you that I have limits too. There are many things that I can be non-judgmental about, and I've learned to listen openly to a lot of things. That's my job. But there are still things that I have trouble with. One of them is listening to people obsessed with social media. Who posted what on Instagram? And who didn't like my comment on Facebook? And what happened on Snapchat? And why wasn't included in that group? I mean, I can't even sometimes follow the nuances of where the technology has taken us. But when I listen to this, sometimes I get very frustrated and annoyed, and I'm kind of like, let's just get a life. But when I feel myself doing that, I know that I have lost my neutrality. I'm being judgmental. And when I find my way back and say, let me just listen to this and see what's going on, I always find something important about that person's particular experience. Even in the impersonal world of social media, each individual is having their own experience. And if we can listen to it without judging it, there's always something to understand. But it is like working out a muscle, to use the gym metaphor. We got to do it. We get stronger. And when we are stronger, it is useful in everyday life. As one patient said to me, I've learned it's important to say, okay, and that's taken a lot of work, but I can now accept talking about bad things. And then he said, wouldn't it be great if everyone could be non-judgmental and open to understanding? And I couldn't agree more. This is Dr. JKB signing off. Since we are exploring together, you make the journey all the richer by subscribing to the show on iTunes. And even better, if you also leave a rating, it helps others to find us. If you have a story about how the concept in this episode helped you figure out something in your life, send it in, please. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter at Psychonaut Show. Show notes are on the website, thepsychonautshow.com. And if you leave me a question, it may well be an inspiration for an upcoming episode. Until our next trip, judge nothing, question everything, and remember, there's always a reason. Bye for now. The Psychonaut Show was created and produced by yours truly, John Burton. Art and web design by Hunter Creative. Post-production and sound design by Julio Gonzalez of Zimmer Media. Zimmer Media can be found online at zimmer.co. That's X-I-M-E-R.co.